Welcome to The Process Podcast, an interview series focused on the process of survival as a creative. Season 6 features conversations with visual artists and curators and gallerists from the Bay Area of California. These conversations took place during a 3-month-long residency at the Growlery, an incredible organization based in San Francisco, who facilitated many of these conversations. They can be found at thegrowlery.org. We have also launched a Patreon for those who want to and are able to provide some financial support for the show to help us keep going. You can learn more about why we've launched that and where the money goes and how it will help us grow at patreon.com/theprocessco. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we hope you dig the season. Cheers, y'all.
Hello. Here we are.
This is one of two final episodes of this season that we recorded while at the Growlery in San Francisco during an artist residency. And this conversation is with Tamara Porres, who is an artist, writer, and educator originally from Brooklyn, New York, currently living in San Francisco Bay Area, specifically in Berkeley, I believe. As an artist, photography is her nucleus, but around it are installation, filmmaking, writing, sculpture, and performance. In her work, she explores the fluid relationships of time, memory, and history through a photoconceptual, research-centric practice. Her academic research interests currently center on photo-based artists who engage with archival practices to recenter histories. She has exhibited nationally, including places like Brooklyn Museum, the school at the International Center of Photography, and Embark Gallery in San Francisco, and many others. Her writing has been published on Art Practical and Contemporary, and she teaches at many esteemed universities. She also just released That Which We Cannot Ever Expect to See, a series of poetic assemblages that consider photography's relationship to the universe. And that is published on Smeen Smeen Books. I picked up a copy at a book fair, at the New York Art Book Fair, and it is rad AF. It's very cool. It looks like a newspaper, and you open it up and it is full of treasures and amazing prints and surprises, and it's beautiful. And you can find a link to it at theprocess.co. along with links to Tamara's website and Instagram and all of that. She also just recently announced, I believe, her and our friend Keija Lucas, who is a past interviewee, are working on a project together. So make sure you check out their Instagrams to learn more about that. In the meantime, on this episode, I know I should not identify favorites, but this was definitely one of my favorites, in the very least, to revisit as I was editing it. We talk about all sorts of stuff, including how and why she utilizes archives within her work. When you do check out her work, and as you hear us talk about it, it's very archival. She's doing something very different with found images, and it is pretty cool. We also discuss thinking about photographs as language to craft associative poems, where her work comes from, and how she fuses autobiographical elements into something that can be more universal. This is a big one. The experience of learning that her dad is not her biological father in her late 20s, and adding a twist, there's also a race component. No spoiler alerts here. I mean, that's kind of one. We dive into that, and it's something that is at the core of her work. So yeah, I'm not going to keep listing things that we talk about. It's a great episode. I loved it. I hope you do too. And yeah, nearing the end of the season. Be sure, if you are new here, to subscribe so you can be notified when the last episode of the season goes live next week, but also be informed when we come back in the new year, because we will be back. We have a season that kind of goes back to our roots, is a little bit all over the place. There's no real theme, at least not that I know of yet. But I'm stoked on it. I'm very excited to dive back into those conversations because it's been a minute since I recorded some of them. I think that's it. Hope you enjoy, and everyone's staying calm and enjoying the holidays to the best of their abilities. I know it can be a stressful time. Deep breaths. Everything We'll be okay. A new year is upon us, etc., etc. Okay, enjoy this episode. Check y'all next week.
My name is Tamara. I'm an artist, writer, and an educator, and I live in Berkeley, California, but I'm originally from South Brooklyn, New York.
How long have you been in Berkeley?
I've lived in the Bay Area for a little under 4 years. I came here for grad school. I went to CCA.
So can you explain the artist side of it? How would you describe your art practice?
Oh boy. It's funny because I write about other people's work, and it's much easier. I would like venture to say maybe easy to write about other people's work, but it's really hard for me to talk about mine. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes from a really hard time separating myself from the work enough to kind of know what it's about. But I think generally photography is like my nucleus, and then around it are installation and filmmaking and writing and even sculpture. Yeah, and I think about photography as like my center, and then from that a number of things emerge out of it. And I'm really interested in utilizing archives within my work. So thinking about archives as sites of possibility for making. So kind of turning the idea of going to an archive to kind of find answers or find information. I'm really interested in existing photographic and archival material as being a site for imagination. I think my work really contends with all the things that are embedded in the photographic objects, like history, memory, physical relationships, the ways we represent and we perceive our world. Currently, I'm using a lot of found print ephemera, so photographs clipped from magazines or science textbooks or, you know, just other kinds of discarded print material, and using them to create these associative poems. So thinking about photographs as language, right? Mm-hmm. Like as we can write with words, we can write with photographs. And yeah, but I came from a long history of like documentary photography, like so-called like straight photography. And I'm really still like kind of personally really interested in that kind of work, but the work that I'm making now is much more fictive, I think, mm-hmm. than nonfiction. My work kind of comes from a lot of personal history stuff, so meditating on autobiographical parts of my life, kind of infusing the autobiographical into something that can be more universal. And I think that's something I've always done. I've always been really interested in how my story can extend out to larger concerns and conversations and become like an entry point for others. But the visual language has just changed over time from documentary to more conceptual stuff.
So you explained what attracts you to like the archival stuff, mm-hmm. and the found imagery, but like where do you think that comes from?
It comes from a pretty specific place. I think, well, I've always been really interested in family photographs. Mm-hmm. I remember growing up, I would spend tons of time with my grandma just going through old photos, listening to her stories, making sense of my family through photographs. Before I asked questions, I liked to kind of come up with an answer myself. Mm-hmm. And so I would use the photographs to make sense of like, oh, here's this person and here's their relationship to me, to that, you know, to others. So I spent a lot of time just with my grandma, my family, like looking at family photographs. It was always something I was interested in from when I was a little kid. I did a project in undergrad that maybe I'll come back to where we used family photographs to kind of map the history of religion in my family. My mom's side of the family is from Spain. And so they were very Catholic. And I also grew up Catholic. And so I was looking for that story in the photographs. And then actually, so I abandoned that for a long time, I think because I thought that making photographs meant making new things,
yeah.
New photographs. But when I came to grad school, because I learned when I was 27 that my father I grew up with wasn't my biological father.
Oh, when you were 27?
When I was 27.
Yeah.
Just about to turn 28. It's like in April, my birthday's in May.
So this was just like a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a little bit under 4 years ago. Yeah, so when my mom told me that, apropos of nothing, I mean, I was doing a video actually, ironically, about my dad who raised me. I made a lot of work about my family. That was like the thread throughout a lot of my life. And in making that video, my mom revealed after the camera was off, which was kind of like the biggest crime for me. I was like, why didn't you say this on tape?
Right.
You know? So she revealed that to me, and with my grandma, pulled out a little bag filled with photographs of her and my biological father when they were together, and a bunch of letters that he wrote her, and my real birth certificate which has a different last name, and no father listed as person. My birth certificate that I have grown up with has listed my father who raised me as my father, which is an interesting kind of lie that extends into institutional documents. But
yeah.
But so she pulled out this little archive, essentially, and just gave it to me. It was like, this is yours now to do what you will with it. And then I was like, well, one, I'm going to go to grad school instead of going to therapy, because I think that's what artists do, I think. So I went to grad school instead of therapy. It's very expensive. And I decided that I would try to contend with this story. But I wasn't interested in making a documentary. Actually, around that time, I started just seeing all around me all these documentary pieces about your parents, who you think are your parents and not your parents, just sort of kind of coming up from the woodwork out of nowhere. And so I decided, I was like, well, at this point, I don't want to use the language I know to make this. I want to find new language to talk about this. And so that's why I came to grad school. And that's really what started in my art practice, using the archive as a language. It really began there because I was left with this little archive to make sense of my identity,
right,
with these disparate pieces that had very little information and had all these gaps.
Yeah.
And that's so much of what an archive is. An archive is like what's not there. It also really made me think of, too, the ways in which photographs can be read incorrectly.
Yeah.
And we can read things into photographs that are there, but not exactly how we conceive of them. I mean, in my family photographs, there's like me and my dad there. And he's my dad. You know, he's a person I grew up with who raised me, but the story wasn't exactly what I just assumed, like a normative kind of story. And so
was
I began to think about,
you're like an infant?
He and my mom got married when I was two.
Okay.
So before I formed any memories. But, you know, I kind of made up a story based on the photographs. I made up a fiction. I was like, oh, I knew that I was like born out of wedlock. Like I was an oops baby. And I just figured that they had like a one-night stand, or they were dating, and they're like, I don't know if we should get married. You know, I just kind of came up with this story, and nobody denied that was, no one said that was not true.
Right.
No,
yeah.
No one denied me. Everyone was just like, oh, yeah, no, sure.
Something
you
like
know,
that.
Yeah. And the things you say to kids, right?
Yeah.
And, but it just kind of extended into adulthood. And so it really made me think about the photograph as an unfixed thing. The photograph is the story we tell ourselves about the image. It's a surface. It's not a window. It's like a wall in many ways. Yeah. And so I really, in addition to thinking about archival material as a kind of like formal language, I also really think about like philosophically the photograph itself. That's just something that I think has been also coming up in my work more recently, where I use a lot of iconography of photography to think about our relationship to it, our relationship to imaging ourselves, to making sense of ourselves through images, which, you know, is something that is not unique to 2019. It's been happening since, you know, throughout the history of visual art, as early as cave paintings in France. And so I think we've, you know, as humans have had a desire to tell our story visually, and photography is just one mode, but it is a ubiquitous one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that I'm really interested in from a personal level, but also kind of in a more macro way.
Yeah. By the way, you're great at talking about your art.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't want to fixate on your personal life.
Do it. I talk about it all the time. Okay.
Were you like angry at all at your mom?
I was.
Yeah.
I was. I think I was angry. I was angry because I was lied to.
Yeah.
For so long by everybody.
Right.
Like everybody knew except me.
Yeah.
My grandma knew. My dad. My not biological father. My dad who raised me obviously knew. He knew I wasn't his kid because he didn't meet me till I was a baby.
Right.
And so I was mad about being lied to because I hate being lied to. Who likes it? I don't know. Nobody likes it. But I mean,
you were lied to about your identity.
Oh, my whole identity.
Yeah.
And there's another level to it that's pretty deep that I haven't accessed in my visual art making, though I have written about it. I started writing when I was in grad school too. Through this class that I took with a local writer named Dodie Bellamy, and it really changed my life. Her class and her just approach to writing really, really shifted my direction. But there's also a racial and ethnic component of the whole thing. My mom is from Spain, and my dad who raised me is from Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up with that as my identity, right? As a mixed race, white presenting Latina. Like that's just the identity that I had and embodied and worked through and like negotiated and experienced for almost 28 years.
Yeah.
And to then learn that my biological father. It's like a white blonde guy from Canada.
Oh my God.
You know? The fuck? You know? So I think that was actually the biggest loss for me.
Yeah.
And I don't even know that it's a loss, but it's something that I don't know how to make work about it. I've tried to make some pieces about it because I think that like this is something that really makes our kind of conversations about race and ethnicity really complex. And like, what about people who are these kind of wrinkles? You know, I'm very confused about, I don't know what box to check anymore. I used to kind of have a sense of what box to check and used to have a sense of like, you know, which spaces I did or didn't belong in. And like basically worked for, you know, 20 odd years to like understand my place in the world and how to navigate it based on what I look like, based on how I grew up, based on the things that I experienced in the world. And so now my biological identity is something that is like dissonant from who I feel like I am,
right?
Who I still am. And so I think that was the thing that was the most angry at. I was most angry about because I was like, you knew that I was doing all this work. I talked about it all the time. My mom and dad didn't really talk about race or ethnicity. I think it just wasn't in their like kind of lexicon. Like that was something that, you know, neither of them really saw as like important in a way. But I did all the time. I talked about it all the time. And I talked about what does it mean to be Latina? What does it mean to be white? What does it mean to be both of these things and none of these things? Like I just, you know, I just went through it, you know, for these years, read a lot and talked a lot, you know.
It's almost like your soul knew that something was up.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Exactly. And it was something, I actually, the kind of interesting thing was when my mom told me, she told me by saying, I have something to tell you and it's going to change your life forever. And I knew.
Wow.
I told her, I was like, I know what you're going to say and I just need you to say it.
Yeah.
And I knew. And so there was something that I felt, and I think that's probably why I was making all this family work, while I was trying to understand my dad. We didn't have a good relationship, really. It's like a lot of kind of tension and difficulty. And, you know, he's in my life. Him and my mom are still together. And, you know, we actually have a better relationship now, I think, than we had up until that point. But
knowing that he like essentially adopted you, right?
Yeah.
Not to say that always is whatever. Can but there's go a number of different directions. But
there was something where it was like, oh, you didn't have to be here.
Right.
You could have been somewhere else. And he really could have.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're here probably because you like want to be,
right?
You know, and to some extent, you know, and so I did all this work. Like I went to Spain with my mom, with my grandma actually, and like did all this photography work there to understand, okay, what does it mean to be from Spain? Then I went to Nicaragua with my dad when I was in college to understand what does it mean to be from Nicaragua. Also thinking about navigating like, you know, histories of colonialism that exist between these two spaces and like, you know, kind of interpersonally. And so it was just like, I felt like there was like, you know, couple decades of work.
Yeah, you've dedicated a lot to
a lot of time and energy to also then understanding myself.
Yeah.
But I still feel like I'm this like work in progress. Like I don't understand myself and I don't understand who I am and where I fit and where I belong. And I was like just kind of trying to get there and sort of getting there, and to have the rug pulled out from under me, that was the biggest thing, because that was something I don't think I gained, but I lost.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, I gained potentially a new dad. I don't know him, but like, you know, maybe.
Right.
This was like, oh, I didn't gain a new identity. I lost the one that I had worked so hard to try to understand.
Yeah.
There's this book, this novel by this author, Ben Lerner, who I've always loved his poetry. So I've read his poetry for many years. And Ben Lerner wrote this novel in the 2010s. I don't know exactly the date, maybe 2014. I'll just throw that out there. But he wrote this novel called 1004, in which he writes about, this is like a sort of ancillary story within it, but he writes about meeting this woman. They're in the Prospect Park like food co-op, like, I don't know, bagging onions or something. And she starts telling him this story, and I felt like he had written my story.
Wow.
She starts telling him the story. She's a Lebanese woman, Lebanese and white, and starts telling the story about how her mom eventually revealed that her dad wasn't her biological father. Mm-hmm. And her father, she wasn't Lebanese. And she said this thing, I'm not going to say the quote exactly. It's like a longer quote, but she has this thing where, and he wrote her saying, my hands started to pale.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that.
Wow.
And it wasn't just that my hands started to pale because I was in shock, but like my hands started to pale because I felt like the color leaving my body, like the kind of like I had this like moment of shock where like the blood was like rushing away from my limbs, but I also had this idea of this whitewashing happening. And I felt like I had lost this side of my identity that I had grown up with. That was a big part of who I was, that I had also just worked so hard to kind of like overcome just like personal, interpersonal stuff with my dad, trying to make sense of that and like kind of working on my relationship with him to working on understanding what it meant to be from Nicaragua and what it meant to be Latina and like kind of in, you know, and in the whole host of who I was. Also like being a kid from immigrant parents in Brooklyn, like, you know, I was born here, but I didn't speak Spanish till I was in school. And I didn't speak English until I was in school. And so, you know, also kind of growing up with this language and, you know, this kind of experience of isolated from America in a way. And yeah. And so it was just this thing where I was like, oh, my hands started to pale. Like I felt that like something had left.
Yeah.
I felt something leave that maybe I never had at all, but I felt like I did, you know? And so that when I read that story,
I mean, you did have it. Also, I don't know if this means anything, like if it actually makes sense, but I feel like you're an example or proof that like a character can transcend identity or something like that. Or like, I don't know if it's a question of nature versus nurture, but like, can you still identify? That's, I always struggle with that word.
Nicaraguan. Nicaraguan.
Do you feel that you can identify with it still? Because it's, you spent like even a chunk of your adulthood.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, formative years, right? Like the first quarter of your life is kind of how you, I don't know, how you develop based on your relationship to yourself, to your family, to the world's relationship to you, and, you know, all those ways. You know, it's hard. I think also it's hard because in Latin America, there are many Latinx people who are super white.
Yeah.
Like, who are blonde and blue-eyed, right? It's just the history of colonialism. It's embodied. And so, for me, it didn't resonate as wrong that I'm so light-skinned, that I'm so white, right? It just didn't. Because there are so many other people like me out there. And that just is like, you know, kind of the luck of the draw of genetics and the baggage that you kind of carry and have to negotiate in terms of like which physical body you embody in this racialized world.
Yeah.
And kind of coming to terms with what that means and, you know, and the complexities of that. And so in a sense, it's like, because of how I look, I feel like I have done a lot of work to understand the complexities of that and also try to do so in a way that didn't like whitewash my cultural heritage, you know, where it's like, yeah, I didn't speak English till I was five. And so like my relationship to Spanish, which is also complex because it's like a colonizer's language. And so that also kind of resonates with a lot of kind of issues there. But, you know, I didn't speak the language, didn't speak English till I was a kid. And, you know, I grew up in house that was different than my peers growing up and, you know, have family from all different parts, you know, from, I don't have a lot of family in the States. So a lot of my family's in Nicaragua and in Spain. And a lot of my dad's side of the family is in Miami actually. And so, yeah, so I think it's hard because I feel like it's a kind of double-edged sword, like identifying as Nicaraguan and Spanish both is perhaps a lie, because biologically I am not Nicaraguan, but would not identifying as such erase my family,
right?
And how I grew up and who they are, because my dad, when I told, so I didn't tell my dad for like 2 years that I knew, oops. And so,
and your mom didn't tell?
No, because I told her, I was like, this is my story now, and I get to tell whomever I want when I want,
right?
I also wanted to do it on camera, so I have that on camera somewhere. So when I told my dad, his whole thing was like, well, so what? What changes? You're the same. I'm the same. Nothing changes. And I'm like, oh, but like nothing has changed and like everything has changed.
Yeah.
You know, he's older. He, you know, he doesn't come from like a lot of money and so like education.
It's like a masculine and old school thing to say.
Yeah. And like, I just don't think like, you know, I think like also like encountering kind of like discussing like politics of race and ethnicity, especially in like the developing world, like I don't think like, you know, he had time for that.
Yeah.
Like he had to work. He's like a mechanic. He had to like work. He came to this country, had to like get a job in Nicaragua, didn't have money either, had kids. Like he, like, I don't think he had time to like really engage with like the histories of, and it's not this, you know, it's not to kind of diminish his experience, but I think for him, like this stuff doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's like, you are who you are, you know, which is also kind of like a, you know, kind of problematic relationship. you know, to race ethnicity that exists. But yeah, I think for him, like, he was just like, well, nothing changes. You're still my daughter. Right. Right. You know, like, I think he also was just like, well, you're my kid.
Right.
And so I find complexity in that. And like, if I don't identify in this way, is that an act of erasure of basically the people who impacted me and made me who I am?
Yeah.
And I think it's a pretty hard thing. And I don't know how to answer it. And I think I just have like avoided it.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have several half siblings. My dad has a few kids with a couple different women. He's got one that's older than me from a previous marriage, and then a couple of younger kids with another woman. And then my mom and my dad didn't actually have my dad had raised me. They actually didn't have a kid until I was 17.
Oh, okay.
Like a kid together. Okay.
Yeah, younger.
And so I have a younger. He's now my half brother, but he doesn't know. So yeah, I have a younger half brother who's like I grew up, I mean, you know, till for 10 years, he's my full brother. And we're very similar in a lot of ways. I also think it's kind of funny too, because I'm very similar to my dad who raised me. We have a lot of shared traits, I think, like similar sense of humor and, you know, kind of like depressive tendencies. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, you know, because that's like a nature versus nurture. I don't know where that comes from.
Have you seen that documentary about the triplets who were separated at birth?
Yeah, if you're identical strangers.
Yeah. The whole nature versus nurture thing, I was just like,
whew. It's so deep.
Yeah.
It's so deep.
I'm not going to try to tell you what your art's about, but I wonder.
But do.
But your focus on and fascination with the universe, which a lot of people, you know, kind of like think about the universe, right? But mm-hmm. I feel like yours, the way your art, and I'll let you talk about it in the show that's going to be here, but the way your art speaks to it, I wonder, like, I'm seeing a link that I'm, like, struggling to find the words to describe between this whole idea of what is family, what is identity, how are we all connected? You were talking about the universe is colliding, like, is that you and your dad? You're the one who raised you, you know? Like, I wonder if you subconsciously, maybe some of your work does relate to that part of the whole thing.
I think all of my work comes from all my work right now and for the last 4 years, and honestly, maybe forever. maybe it's all, I think it all comes from that.
Yeah.
And I think in grad school, I tried to make, while I was at CCA, I really was trying to make work that kind of directly relayed the story, even if it was in a slightly ambiguous, circuitous kind of way. And since graduating, so I put up my thesis show in 2017. So for the last 2 years, I've been trying to use similar formal language and material to broaden the story. Mm. So if I'm thinking about this universe work, and I just started making it, you know, really, I mean, I've been collecting images of space, these archival images of space, pretty much since 2015, like since I kind of heard about this story, I just started unconsciously collecting these images of the cosmos. And I've been amassing this pile of papers for a while and really not knowing what to do with it. And so I do wonder, I mean, as I start to make sense of this new body of work, I do wonder if I'm really thinking about mapping our place in the universe, this kind of idea of stars as both as like location, like locators, like you can kind of map where you are and where you're going based on the stars, like this, you know, sort of celestial map, but also this idea of like in the earth, we live in this closed system. And so myself and this biological father character who exists out there in the world, like we've looked at the same sky, really, you know, like we've looked at the moon and the moon is the same. Yeah. The moon is there. It's this body that's larger than all of us and larger, you know, than any of us can relate to. And it's shared. I think a lot about the ocean too, like the ocean, was the Atlantic Ocean at any rate. And I was on Lake Ontario for a summer, which is a body of water that's shared between upstate New York where I was and then the part of Canada where my biological father is supposedly from. And I just thought a lot about this like closed system, this lake, as this shared thing. And really all water in this closed system cycles through and it's all shared, right? All these shared molecules like throughout history, right? And so there's something about it that I think about, you know, like just sort of historical legacy, that this earth is the same earth that our ancestors have walked on, that, you know, folks have, the skies are the same skies that folks have looked at for millennia, as long as, you know, throughout human history. And so there's something that about that that I think is in like why I'm interested in it, you know, and too that I think there's some beautiful poetry in not knowing all the facts. Like in the images that I'm working on for the show, I don't really know, mostly because I cut around the captions, but I don't really know what all the images are of. They just reference these generalized signs of stars or galaxies, nebula, like celestial bodies, the moon, planets. Like these are images that we can essentially like make sense of, even if we can't pinpoint exactly the number of which galaxy or formation this is. And so I'm interested in a more affective reading than a factual one. Mm-hmm. And I think that also has to do with just my kind of skeptical relationship about the facts contained within photographs. Like I'm interested in how an image makes you feel, mm-hmm. less than I am in a deductive reading,
yeah.
where you are trying to understand what is the image about.
Right.
I want to feel it.
Yeah.
And so I think there's all of that comes from, yeah. it's all dad stuff at the end of the day.
Right. Something dad issues.
Yeah. So I was actually jokingly for a while, I was calling my practice while I was in grad school. I was calling my practice sad dad stuff. So I still feel like it's that.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel one of the reasons why I think I felt like I had to spend time in San Francisco, not one of the reasons, like the reason why I felt like I had to spend time here is my mom lived here for like a year, I think, maybe a little bit longer, in like a shared house. I think her brother also lived there, did the whole hippie thing. She was like pretty extreme hippie. I think my whole family and like close friends know that the life that I live is very much like me feeling that I have to live out the life my mom would have lived if she didn't have a family. But she convinced herself she needed a family because hers was so fucked up and whatever. And I think like, I don't think we killed her, but or like made her drink. I think she drank because she had mental illness. I was never treated. Anyway.
Yeah.
But I feel like the past few years have been me like living this life that, because I think my mom should have lived it. I don't know. It's very strange how these ancestral, like, I don't know, how these lines of programming and weird family connections.
They're the things we carry. Make do things. Yeah, they're the things we carry with us, that the forces that push us in one direction to another, right. the duty we think we have to fulfill, or our destiny. Even there's, it's all the stuff that we carry.
Yeah.
From both our lived experience and our ancestral one. I mean, you know, I'm really into this idea of, you know, like that. I mean, I don't know really like what the scientific term it might be, but like this idea of like the experiences of the people who've come before us, like being very much like in our bodies and in our DNA today. And that doesn't just mean like, oh, you're X percent this and X percent that from this place. It's like, what is the history of your line? Mm. Like, what is the history of your family line? Like, what things that they did they experience, traumatic or not, that are infused in you? And I think that's, you know, those legacies are really meditated on, you know, very much by like people of color, especially in the United States with this history of like slavery and colonialism and genocide. I mean, it's like a pretty intense thing, especially for folks of color here, but it's something that I think all people need to meditate on. Like, what are the things that came before you that you should contend with? And I think especially for, you know, for white folks who maybe for the first time are being confronted with their own whiteness, if we changed cultural conversation to really be thoughtful and considerate of all of the things that have come before us, ugly or not, all of that we'd see kind of inscribed in our bodies and inscribed in the way we walk through the world. And it was something that I think would be a space to create more equity if everyone's having those conversations, you know, but it's something that has to be, you're either forced by the world to learn it and experience it, or you have to do the work to learn it, you know?
Yeah, it's so true. I think my experience here has made me think about my whiteness a lot.
Really?
Yeah, and I like don't really know what it's making me think. It's just made me meditate on it more. And it's not guilt, but I think it's trying to figure out where I fit in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Usually it's keep my fucking mouth shut because it's what I think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, listening is key.
Yeah.
Listening is super important, and being self-reflective is very important. And educating yourself, you know, it's like educating oneself is a huge thing. And I think trying and making mistakes and being an ally, standing up, you know, for what you believe in spaces where maybe you are safer than someone else to stand up.
And I feel like I'm learning ways in which I can do that, just like you said, by listening. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, my ignorant self did not realize that's an issue for you. Like, fuck, that's something I can stand up for when I see it somewhere else.
Yeah. And it's lifelong work. Like, it's lifelong work and it's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be uncomfortable. Like, if it feels really good to, like, confront your, you know, kind of position in, you know, racial and systemic inequality, then it's like, oh, you're probably not doing it right. Because it, like, it should feel, especially for white folks, it should feel, should hurt, you know? Because it's, especially if it's, like, kind of an early stage at, like, confronting who you are and what legacies you come with and what that means and has meant. It should feel off, and it should feel like you got, it's like exercise, you got to do the work,
right?
You know? And I think that's something that, because it's not easy and it's not pretty and it's not linear,
yeah,
I think that makes a lot of folks feel like, well, if I don't have to deal with this, like, I'm just not gonna.
Right.
Because it's not fun. It's not pleasant. And so
I live in my bubble.
So I think it's good. I think it's important that you're doing that, and that just, you know.
Yeah.
That's lifelong stuff. It's like, no, just, we're going to keep going.
Totally. You know? Totally. Yeah. Feel very inspired here to do so. So it's good. Switching gears a little bit, but not too much. You know, you've mentioned meditating on things quite a bit and, like, intuitive work. When did you start tapping? Have you always been an intuitive person, I guess? Like, where did that come from? Because that's not the norm, right? We're all intuitive internally, but we've been programmed and trained by society and capitalism to not live that way. Or create work that way.
Honestly, I think it's been an experience in the past couple years that I've tried to think about. When I came to grad school, I came with a much more documentary-focused formal language. Even if I was making conceptual documentary type work, it still was very much like, I have a story, I have an idea, and I'm going to execute it in photographs, and I plan out the images, and that's not to diminish that practice. I think that practice is really important and good for many folks to do, and produces a lot of beautiful work, but it was kind of the only thing I knew how to do.
Mm.
I made work that, like, to be honest, had, like, a lot of literal qualities too. It was really literal work. And when I came to grad school, I really came here to break apart that language, not to abandon it. And I think that was something that, like, in grad school, wasn't really making photographs per se, like, photography was it's the thing that I love. It's my first love. It's, like, my only love. And so I will never leave it. I don't know what terrible things it could do to make me leave it, but, you know, I don't know. But I think it's just also how I think and how I process.
The iPhone.
I kind of love it. I kind of love the iPhone because it means I don't have to carry a big camera around most of the time, but I can still make pictures. I've actually been making a lot of video on my iPhone because the camera's really good for video. Yeah, and so when I came to grad school, I was trying to make things that didn't tell a literal story. I got some really good advice from one of my professors a couple years ago that just really resonated with me, where he said to me, my advisors, he said, I want you to think about the simplest gesture you can make. What is the simplest gesture you can make in your work and make that? Because I think I spend a lot of time overthinking things. I also don't have a lot of studio time because I work 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And so I don't have a lot of time to be in the studio. So I do spend a lot of time in my head. And I think what that does, because I'm not in the studio often enough for a long enough time to feel comfortable just making a mark and just making a gesture, that I think I kind of overcomplicate things a lot. That advice that he gave me was really resonant, because I felt like I had permission to just do something simple, even if it wasn't telling, and especially if it wasn't telling this, like, really clear, linear story, and it maybe was more intuitive.
Yeah.
And it was something that I didn't exactly know what it meant, but I just did it, and then I kind of figured it out.
If someone said that to me, I probably would have just wanted to punch them in the face. I'm like, what does that even mean?
But, you know, it's like, just don't overthink things. Just do it. Just do the thing. Make something.
Yeah.
And it takes me a long time to finish stuff. Like, in terms of projects, like, I can work on a project for years. Mm-hmm. And I think that also is just kind of how I work. But maybe instead of writing an epic, you know, 10-part novel, I can, like, write a short story.
Yeah.
That will then become part of this bigger project. And so that was in He told me that in, I guess it was the fall of 2016, right before my thesis year at CCA. And it really stuck with me because I just felt like I had permission to just make things that felt good to make or felt like they had to be made and not feel like I had to just overwork them, like over knead the dough, right? Just until it's like stringy and terrible and tough. And that's something as since I've been here at the Growlery, I've been trying to, knowing that I've had such limited time, it's ironically been the busiest 2 weeks or 2 months of work that I've had in a while. I haven't had a day off since like mid-January. So I was like, well, okay, I keep trying to make things and spinning my wheels and not knowing what it's about. And this has been a couple months of just coming back to simple gestures I've made. I was showing you some work from, I think, the summer of 2017, making these photograms in the darkroom when I was teaching a little middle school class at City College. We were in the darkroom together. I was there for, you know, a bunch of hours, a few times a week. And I just started making photographs because I didn't have any negatives. Also, I hadn't shot film, black and white film, in forever. But I had all this, you know, kind of old found photographs that I actually found in that darkroom and like piles of stuff. And so I just took some paper, started ripping them, started creating these photograms using that material and didn't think anything of it. I just was like kind of making intuitively because I also found a bunch of expired paper. I was like, oh, this is going to go in the garbage or I'm going to use it. So, and it was like fogged and weird and, you know, wouldn't fit for a class. And so I just started making these images and kind of put them in a box and showed them to a few people who were like, I don't know what this is. And I was like, okay, I'll just put them away. No one likes them. But I came back to them as I was looking through. I had a studio visit here a few weeks ago. And as I was looking for stuff to show her, I was like, oh, these photograms. Yeah, they've been hanging out. Okay, like simple gesture. Like I've been trying to make these images of assemblages of found photographs. Maybe I just make photograms like I've been doing. And so that was kind of like my return back to the simple gesture, which is a really good lesson, I think, that a simple gesture doesn't mean that it's vapid. It doesn't mean that it's conceptually without. It just means that the methodology can also just fit a smaller scale.
Yeah.
And that's okay. There's like permission to do that.
Right. Because the fact that you're still making art considering how much you work is pretty mind-boggling. And not only like creating art, like a shit ton of art, of like really good art, great art.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's hard. It sucks. But it's like what living in the Bay Area is like.
Coming from someone from New York, to remind listeners.
Yeah, I'm from Brooklyn. And it was hard there. It's way harder here. I think too, there's something in New York. I don't feel a level of precarity in New York that I do here.
What do you mean?
It feels like we're on unstable ground here.
Yeah.
There's something about this place that feels like everything might fall at any moment. And you know what?
Because
it fucking will. That's why. Because the big earthquake's coming and I feel it all the time. I feel it with mini earthquakes all the time and it's in my head and it's fine. There's a level of precarity here that is so present where I feel like in New York, I was living like way paycheck to paycheck, but also I was working full time. I knew where my next paycheck was coming from and exactly how much it was going to be for. So I was stable in that way. And I worked full time. I mean, I worked pretty much a predictable full time job since I was 18, but especially when I graduated college, I was a school teacher and I worked for a nonprofit. I had the same salary, I had the same schedule, like everything was the same. Here, I got laid off in 2016 I was working for my nonprofit part-time and they laid me off at the end of my first year of grad school, which was super cool of them to do. Yeah, that was great. And then since then, I've just been working part-time, gig-based things, freelance. I'm trying to adjunct because also a big part of becoming to grad school was I didn't want to be a professor. I've been teaching for a long, long time and teaching in higher ed is the thing that I've wanted to do the most for my whole life. I've just like always envisioned myself working in a college with young art students. It's like the thing that gives me life to make my own work.
More so than like if you could have a full-time career as an artist. It's the same thing, but you know what I mean? Like just creating your art.
If I could just have a career as an artist and then like just pop in to like adjunct here and there when I wanted to,
yeah,
that'd be tight. I mean, I want to be an artist, like that's, and I want to talk about art and I want to be in art every single day.
Yeah.
And the only way that I think I can maintain a really like deep art practice, I think I'll always make work because I always did. Mm-hmm. Even when I had a full-time job, I was making work and teaching all the time on my off time. But I think the way to do it where I'm actually like deepening my work and not just working at a kind of a plateau mm-hmm. is to be in education. Because I think the really key thing for artists is you have to make money somehow. And if you can make money to live through your work, like fucking fantastic, like do that. That is the goal. But most of us can't, mm-hmm. most of us won't. And so you have to find the thing, the job to exist in this capitalist system where it'll feed you. Mm-hmm. It won't drain.
Literally and theoretically.
Literally will feed you. But I don't think the job needs to feed you like emotionally, spiritually. Because you have your artwork for that. Like you have your creative life for that. I think it just needs to not drain you.
Mm.
The job needs to leave your creative energy alone.
Yeah.
And that's why I will never like have a career photographing weddings or editorial. Like I'm not doing that. That work is for me.
Yeah.
Like that energy is for me. And so I'd much rather have adjacent jobs. Like I work in two jobs in museums right now, which I love. Actually, I really like those jobs do feed me. Actually, both nourishment to buy food and also conceptually and spiritually. Like, I think actually I do get really fed from that work because I'm around art and artists all the time, essentially. And I can talk to people about being an artist. I don't have to hide that because I don't have to worry that it's going to make me seem like less committed to the mission or whatever. Like, I can totally like wait. Like, in fact, I think it's an asset.
Mm.
And so my two jobs, my two day jobs, part-time gig-based things at these museums are awesome because it really is adjacent in a way that feeds me. But I also really like thrive on predictable full-time schedule.
Yeah.
Like I like to know where I'm going to be, when I'm going to be there, how long, and I like it to be the same.
Mm.
And I can kind of do that at times, but it also, I was coming back to the precarity thing. I never know what 1 month to the next is going to really look like. So I feel like I just need to take everything when I can. I mean, like the next month I'm going to have maybe like a third of the work that I do now.
Okay.
As of yet, of course, in this city, things work does tend to come up, whether you like it or not. So that is a good thing because there is kind of an abundance of work here. I think we have like the lowest unemployment rate in the country. It's kind of like if you can and want to work, like you can. But it is the thing that makes me feel like, okay, I can never say no to anything because I don't know.
Mm.
And so, yeah. And I've also been adjuncting two classes. And I find like that psychs me up to like, I come back from my classes and I'll go in the dark room for a bunch of hours, or I will like come back here to the growlery and like work in the studio. And so that like confirms to me what I already knew, which is that teaching is the thing that pumps me up.
Mm.
And I'm like psyched about it. And even when it's hard, because it's not easy, teaching is really difficult. And even when it's hard, when it's at its hardest, it's still better than most other things that I've done. Other jobs are exhausting in a particular way that doesn't necessarily, that sometimes pulls from my ability to make work. But that being said, I also really like deadlines. So I think being here has been good because I felt like even though we didn't have to have a show and Keisha's so great and really just like wants this to be a space that can be whatever we want it to be, I really thrive well when I have a deadline because I will in my calendar be like, okay, I have an hour to work in the dark room between this job and that job. I'm going to do that because I'm already in the dark room and then I'll leave straight from here. Or like I have 2 hours in between this thing and that thing. I'm going to go do X, Y, or Z. And so I think a lot of being an artist here in the Bay Area is also just like getting it where you can. We have to adapt to our situations, and that can look a lot of different ways for a lot of different people. And for me, it's been like, okay, you have to just work as much as you can because also it's really expensive here. You have a very expensive art practice.
Yeah.
And I grew up really poor and I don't want to worry about money
mm-hmm.
anymore. And so I like know how to be really thrifty, but I also like want to be able to buy a cocktail sometimes if I would like one. And I'm a grown up now, I'm in my 30s, like I should be able to do that. And so there is something too where I also don't like want to live like I'm 20 again. And just like massing a lot of debt, and even though I have a lot of debt, but I think that's a big thing for me too, where I
but like paying it off rather than
or like know that I will eventually be able to pay it off and then I'll have the means. It's like even if I'm accumulating debt, it's like, okay, I know that I'm also gonna be able to make some money to like not just like rack it up, but like knock a little bit of it down.
Right.
A little, you know? So yeah, I think, and I think, but I also like have to make work. I can't not make work. I think folks have told me, you know, because I'm also a writer and I'm kind of like into more academic thinking. Folks have been like, oh, you should like go be a curator. You should go be a writer. You should do this. I'm like, yeah, like I love those things. I find that work also feeds my art practice. But the thing that I like wake up thinking about every morning is the work that I'm making. Mm. Like that's when I wake up in the morning, when I like take a shower, and I think I heard this guy, he was in public health, but I heard him speak. He Partners in Health, I think was his organization's name. And I heard him speak maybe in like 2006 or something like that. And he said, he's like, the thing you're meant to do is the first thing you think about in the morning. It's the thing you think about when you're taking a shower. It's the thing that doesn't keep you up at night stressing you out, but like keeps you up at night because you're so excited to think about it.
Yeah.
And that's like photography and making work. Like that's the thing that I'll think about. And so that confirms me that although I don't, you know, I have these other things that I can do and I'm not necessarily like, you know, it's not easiest for me to make work. I'm still kind of figuring out what my voice is. Like it's the thing that I'm constantly thinking about and doing so in our most like raw, unfiltered moments. And so I just have to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I wouldn't say this because I'm a freelancer and have freelanced for many years. When you were talking about the taking what you can get while you can because you don't know what's next, there are people out there who are having a moment of Instagram fame who would say that's fear-based living, right? And that you just have to trust that the work's going to be there and say no to the things that you don't want to open up yeses to the things you do want or whatever.
Yeah, it's true.
And it is true. But at the same time, I know the feeling of like, it's also freelance work or like contract work.
Yeah.
Ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes you will have a really busy time and other times it'll be dead. And yeah.
You just have to know how to maximize
right.
that time. It just happens to be that, you know, sometimes often the art opportunities will arise when you have the busiest time
right.
in your freelance life and you can't take vacation days then to, you know, write your thesis or do whatever. But I think we just make it work.
I wonder too if that could potentially be the universe telling you to maybe shed some of the other work and make room for that because who knows what's going to happen. And when I'm using you as a universal you because you were not the only person in this position, but like, you know, to like focus a little bit more on that because who knows where it will lead.
It's true.
Even if that's like a teaching gig or, you know, not necessarily making money off your art because like you said, that's nearly impossible to do.
No one's buying my work. I think I've sold one. I've sold three pieces in my lifetime, two when I was 17 and then one to a coworker when I was like in my late 20s. So no one buys my work, which is fine. It's like, you know, I don't make it for people to buy it though. If they want to, like, you know, please do. But
I can take this out if you want, but like,
yeah,
how much would you charge for a print? For like a,
I think it depends on, I don't know. I'm really bad at this.
Yeah.
Like I don't actually know. And people ask me and I have no idea. When I did a show in the summer, I had these 20 by 24 color prints framed. My friend told me she thinks I lowballed it, but I was charging like $750-$800 for a print, 20 by 24 edition of five, you know, framed. She was like, you definitely lowballed it, but I don't know. But the photograms and, you know, maybe more like darkroom based work and more like unique work would be more probably. So it all depends on like size and kind of like how unique it is and how also like, you know, the kind of cost that went into making it. And, you know, of course what you charge is also very much based on like who you are and your career. And I'm super early, just got here, you know? So I think that's also a part of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
If I had any, and I'm sure you get this a lot, but if I had money and a home, I'd buy your work.
I'll give you a print, obviously, because we're trading. But I also believe that artists should trade work with each other. I think that's a big thing. Like artists and kind of creative people. And I think with our friends and community, like we can have our work have a home with others in our lives. And hopefully, like if eventually people can buy it, they will, you know, and hopefully the other folks who have money can buy it. But I think there is very much a, you know, I believe in like sharing work with people I care about. I think that's an important an important thing because, you know, what good is my work just like sitting in a box, which is mostly where it is.
Right.
Like sitting in a box.
Right.
This also is why I haven't, gotten a full-time job since I've graduated. I could have, and I thought about it quite a lot because it really is a place where I'm going to thrive, but I can't get a full-time job teaching right now. It's just not, it's not going to happen here in the Bay Area. I'm not going to get a job in a college or university here full-time. Why? It's there. The market is crazy. Mm. Everyone's trying to get this job. Everyone's trying to get some security. Mm. And I don't have a ton of college level teaching experience yet. I have tons of other teaching experience, both in like, you know, at the International Center of Photography, where I taught for many, many years, and as an elementary school teacher. So I actually have my master's in teaching. It's kind of crazy, but...
Damn.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. So, you know, I've got that going, but I think it's just not going to happen here. But I do want that to be my career in terms of, like, the kind of paycheck career for many reasons why it's, like, really kind of aligned with how I want to live my life. So I have to leave the Bay Area to do that. And I... like, which is maybe, you know, kind of like a woman thing. I don't know, but I just don't think I'm like qualified enough yet. And the applications are so intense and kind of, you know, daunting, and to put in all that work when you think you're not going to get it anyway. I don't know. So anyway, I'm adjuncting because and even though it's hard and a full-time job would pay me more and be less stressful and be less work, I'm working all these part-time jobs to make sure that I don't just give up on this thing that I want. Because as you know, to apply for a full-time teaching job, you need to have a pretty active, consistent teaching record. And I want to make that. I want to try it. Yeah. I don't want to just default to the thing I know is safe.
Yeah.
Because I did that when I graduated from college. I graduated in 2008, recession, like just begun. I actually feel like I felt the recession coming. Essentially got myself a guaranteed elementary school teaching job in the winter of 2007. I was like, some shit's happening. All the newspapers, what's going on here? I was a photo major. I was like, something weird is like brewing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want my shit to be set.
Yeah.
I'm going to get myself a job. And so I had my August onward planned before the recession hit and before everybody went wild.
Right.
And so I didn't want to do that again, where I was kind of going to the next thing that I felt like I knew I could be good at it, and like I knew that I would be happy, but is this really the thing that like I'm trying to do forever?
Yeah, you're like thinking long term.
Yeah, and maybe it's not gonna work out, and maybe I'll pivot and I'll do something else, you know, because I can be happy. I think about working in a museum often because I really love being around artwork, and I love being around people who love art and think about art and talk about it.
You can be an educator there too, right?
And I'm, but it's part-time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so these are what I do, but, you know, my part-time lives, which is cool, but there is something, you know, where I dig that world a lot, and I really feel like a lot of positivity is happening in museum spaces with young people, people of color, queer people, who are just women who are just kind of, like, changing up institutions from the inside out. But I want to give this, like, being a professor thing a go. I know that the ship is sinking and higher ed is like on the shakiest, most dire of ices, but maybe, you know, maybe I can make it work. And I'm never going to know until I try.
Yeah.
I'm never going to know. So,
You're like me where I'm like, what thing can I do that's completely dying out? Like, maybe you should start a record label.
That sounds
not going to do that. But that sounds, I just want to own a bookstore.
Oh God.
My family's like, you killed me.
Yeah. I actually just saw recently that Amazon has brick and mortar bookstores in New York.
Huh. What the fuck? Why do you...
Like, y'all didn't need to do... Just keep yourself on the internet. If people want to go buy their books in person, can you just go to, like, a small bookstore?
Right. You're like, you've already killed them.
Yeah.
You really just have to hit the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, now you also have to take over brick and mortar, too.
Great.
I recently went to Booksmith, that's up here in Haight. I really liked it, and I bought this. I was reading about the climate change book, Uninhabitable Earth. It's like a horror novel, but also it's real, it's science. And
I've been wanting to read an environmental book.
It's really good. If I finish it and you want it, I'll give it to you, because I'm almost done with it. It's really good, and the library didn't have it, and... Actually, Amazon didn't have it.
No.
I was like, oh, like, well, okay, let me see if I can like go to the bookstore. And I happened to be like on the bus line anyway. And so I just went a couple stops ahead. And yeah, I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'm actually like going to go buy a book in real life. Cause I go to the library a lot. And just like, also I've like gotten into reading like ebooks, like PDFs online because it's, you know, I can just, it's cheap and free and sometimes.
First of all, I feel like you kind of smash the stereotype of artist who doesn't want like the consistency, but a lot of artists I talk to do want, like, I feel like that stereotype should not exist anymore because this is so false.
Well, some people don't. Some people truly don't want it, and they also don't thrive on it.
Right.
I think that's like, you have to just find what you thrive on.
Yeah.
And some people thrive on like unpredictability and like, you know, spontaneity and the ability to just kind of be free, even in lieu of financial precarity. Although I think I grew up super poor, and that desire for stability really comes from that. But like, I don't want to just be broke.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, was growing up, like, I want to be able to buy my art supplies and also eat. I remember when I was in high school, I would have like my little lunch money, and I would save my lunch money to buy film and paper. Mm-hmm. I like wouldn't eat food.
Yeah.
So that I could, you know, save a few bucks here and there to buy film and paper. And I think that was, I'd be like, okay, cool. So like, if I'm going to get this bagel, I'll probably get just a bagel with butter on it, because then I'll save $2, and that $2 is almost a roll of film. Like, this is the math that I would do in my head. I just want, like, the stability really comes from the idea of like, I just want to buy a bare, like kind of the baseline of things to make my work with, without having to like fret about it.
Yeah.
And of course there's always fret and being like, okay, like, you know, trying to figure out, I feel like if I'm in a space where I can't afford to make my work, I may just stop making it. And so my day job feeds that.
Yeah.
And that's really where, you know, and I'm just like, I'm like a Cancer rising. Like, I like home and stability. Like, I don't like a lot of change. And so, you know, but then I'm also a Gemini. So it's kind of like, I also do like a lot of change, but in certain ways, like, I would love to be a person who can just flit around to residencies, place to place, but that's not my financial lot in life. So I can't do that. You know, I think a lot of,
I mean,
you know,
I did it broke, and I don't necessarily recommend doing it broke. I mean, I had a great time. I wouldn't take it back, but the amount of like depression I felt was stupid.
And it's making work while you're depressed. Like, I can't make work like that.
Yeah.
I just won't get out of bed.
Yeah.
And that's real. And I found also too that like, if I'm stressed out about things like money, then it makes me super depressed, and then I won't get out of bed, and I won't like do anything.
Yeah. My health takes a major toll.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's hard. So it definitely is like a thing where, that's like an act of self-care in a way. It's like working the amount that you think you should. You know, but I also think too, like, maybe it's like I'm Benjamin Buttoning it or something, because I was super adult when I was 21.
Oh my God,
I was
same.
Responsible. Right.
Yeah. And I've totally
have you?
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
You know, I had like a good job. I like was making good money for where I was. And,
I think we talked about this. Totally. Yeah. It's definitely trying it out.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. Let's see what happens in our 30s. Like, going a little backwards, but maybe that's okay. I also like, I don't know. I don't have kids. Like, I'm not in any kind of like tied down partnership situation, like, you know, where I have to like ask, kind of be like, oh, like think about, I'm only really thinking about myself, and like, you know, of course, like family, for sure, but really it's like just me. And so might as well now.
You know? Great. What made you first pick up a camera?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm sure I was photographing as a kid, little point and shoot family photographs. I actually have this like toy, like Fisher Price, like puffy toy camera. From when I was looking, like a little, when you press the shutter release button, the lens pops open, like a little clown. Kind of funny. I definitely have that somewhere at my parents' house. So, you know, aside from that, when I was 11, or I guess 10, I had to apply to middle school because New York City makes everything like the college application process. So I had to apply to middle school, and I had no talents, so to speak. Mm-hmm. I didn't take music. I didn't sing. I didn't draw. I like didn't do math exceptionally well. I was like a very good student, but I was kind of a jack of all trades. Like, I didn't really have a thing that I did. But all my friends were applying to this school where you had to apply via talent. Mm-hmm. So like sports, music, whatever. And so I was like, fuck, I really want to go there. All my friends are going there. Like, and that's the good school too. So I had to find some way in. And so I did some research. It's crazy because I was 10. So yeah. The fact that I was like doing this hustle and I was like, all right, what's going on? What are you applying for? What are you doing?
Right.
So word on the street was that the easy talent to get into was media. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know anything about the test or what it was going to be like. They were like, oh, media is easy. Like you should do media. I was like, I don't know what that is. So I was like, okay, I put down media and then I put down creative writing. But I'm also like, which is actually
funny. Were you doing this alone or were you like your parents helping you?
No, I was doing it alone.
This is like, for me. They didn't know. I was so reliant on help when I was 10.
They didn't know. Okay. It's an education in this country is an old boys club, an old white boys club.
Yeah.
It's like, if you're not in the system, if you don't know, tough shit. Like, and I was a really ambitious kid. I'm still pretty ambitious. And I also like, my mom and grandma were both like maids for rich people. And I remember going to like rich people houses and be like, I want this.
Yeah.
I mean, I should have gone into banking or something if I actually wanted that. Right. But I was like, ooh, I want more.
Yeah.
I like want nice things or I want, period, you know? And so I was just like, okay, education is the key. That's one thing my mom and grandma always told me. And like my dad too, they were like, education is the key. You have to do well in school. If you don't do well in school, you're never going to go to college and you're going to be poor forever.
That's like a very immigrant mentality too, isn't it?
Oh my God. Yeah. It's like, if like school is the way, you know, although with the whole college admission scandal, we learned like, yes, school is the way. It's also total garbage because you don't have to work hard depending on how much money you have. You can just fuck around.
Yeah, go America.
You know, great, but also no surprised. So I then applied for media and the media ended up getting in. The test covered, it was like analyzing the movie Twister, which luckily I loved that movie. It was like Helen Hunt and like Bill Paxton, I think. I loved that movie. I was really sad in the beginning because I thought the dog was going to die, but then it doesn't die. So we had to analyze the opening scene, the visual elements of the opening scene in that film. And I guess I did well enough to pass. I also had really good grades, which kind of helped bump you up a little bit if you didn't do exceptionally well on the talent test. You also had like an academic side of it. So my grades are really good. So I got into media. And you got to choose between video and photography, and I just like chose photography out of nowhere.
Again, this is wild that this exists for middle schoolers.
It was a great school. It is a great school, and I really credit it with. Actually, a lot of people who I went to middle school with are still doing the same thing that they got into middle school for, like dance and photography. My best friend went to the same high school, the same middle school, but 2 years younger than me, and she's a photographer. She was in their photography. Like, it's crazy that we didn't know each other, but and I just picked up a camera when I was 11, first time, my Nikon FM10, that I promptly broke pretty much the first couple days that I got it. I just clumsily bumped into a wall and the shutter broke and it cost so much money to fix, but that's okay. And I never stopped. I fell in love with it right away. It's the dark room and the process. I realized I had wanted to be an artist for a really long time. But I'm not good at much of it. I can't paint, I can't draw. It's just not a thing that like is a natural movement for me. But I remember when I was 5, we had this like, what do you want to be when you want to grow up? And I chose artist. I was like, what? You know, and I look back and I also like once chose lumberjack, so I don't know what that's about. But I was like, lumberjack, I'm not physical. Like I don't like exercise. But yeah, I chose artist and I realized, like reflecting on my relationship to photography, it was like the thing that I could do. I was like, oh, I can make art now. And here's this thing and I can see the world. And also it's not something like being an artist didn't come naturally to me. I think I would have had a much easier time if I like became a lawyer or a chemist or something like that. So I think how my mind works, but there's something else that I want that like, I don't feel like a love for anything else. In the same way that I do feel a love for this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like you love a thing that doesn't really love you back. And I think art is like that for me. It doesn't come easy and it's really hard work. And it's hard work that doesn't necessarily take me a ton of time to like make things necessarily, because I found ways to make things with the time that I have. But definitely like the process towards like making something good or interesting is it's been like a lifelong thing, and it will always be a lifelong thing. Like, I'm not, you know, I'm not that naturally inclined as an artist. I once had a person who was a real dick tell me that, like, he's like, well, you know, there are just some people in the world who don't understand poetry. And he was referring to me. And I was like, I hate you. I'm going to be an artist and, like, write poetry. I don't write poetry, but I love it. Yeah. You know, and so there's just, like, a thing where I feel like when the world tells me not to do something, I'm just going to do it harder. So that's what I've been trying to think about.
I appreciate you sharing that. And I think you're, like, the first person to tell me that, first artist to tell me that art doesn't come easy to you. That's something, like, art does not come easy to me at all. And I'm still, like you've heard me talk about taking photos. I'm like, eh.
You're a great photographer. Thank you. You should make more images. Like, thank just you. keep going with your instinct on those, I think. You really, your intuitive way of seeing the world is strong.
Thank you.
And it's just going to get better.
Thank you.
Yeah. I
appreciate that.
But it's not a sexy thing to say.
Like, no.
Making art's not easy. Because art's supposed to be this, like, stroke of genius. Where you're like, oh, like, I'm just so talented. And I just, like, breathed and this work was here. You know, it's like, no, you learned so much. Like, you, even outsider artists who are self-taught, teach themselves. Like, art is a craft, it's labor. And it certain things come easier to certain people, but it's like work either way. And I think if we also, like, decouple that, like, genius artist bullshit, we'll also be able to advocate for art being labor. It's labor and it's a craft.
Yeah.
You're not going to ask a doctor to cut off your foot for free. You know what I mean? Like, oh, like, you can just do the surgery. Like, no, right. It's a craft that they spent so much time, so much money of their lives, like, learning how to do that. Art is the same thing.
Yeah.
But in a society that doesn't really value it, and also that has this myth, this kind of perpetual myth of the artist being this lone genius who's just making it out of nowhere, out of thin air. It's bullshit.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The amount of hours that go into the practice alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Agree. Cool.
Yeah.
Two questions I ask everyone. What's your, like, favorite thing to tell students in terms of, I don't know, you can pick a topic if you want, but either, like, making time to create their work or creating their work as a profession, you pick?
That's a great question. I think the advice that I would try to give anyone, whether it's a student or a person in the creative space or otherwise, is not to ask for permission to make your work or think someone's going to tell you no. Mm. Just make it. Don't tell yourself no. Don't tell yourself why it's not going to work. Don't feel like if your work doesn't fit the parameters of an assignment, of a project, that it shouldn't be made.
Mm-hmm.
Just make it. Just make the work. Make the work and see what happens.
I love that. Last question. What is something you're excited about today?
Okay, I want to say one silly thing and then one not silly thing. So one thing that I'm excited about that's silly is I bought this cake at the Devil's Teeth Baking Company.
Mm.
It's this blood orange cake, and I'm really excited to eat it because I have a mega sweet tooth today/every day. So I'm really excited to eat this piece of cake. So that's one thing. And I think the next thing that... Oh, another silly thing is it's the finale of Top Chef tonight.
Oh.
Yeah. Awesome. It's the finale of Top Chef. I'm really excited about that. And I suppose I'm excited but a little bit less excited to wrap up printing for my show.
Cool.
So I have a few more digital prints left. I'm going to go back to my apartment this evening and print those out, and then go to the darkroom a little bit tomorrow and finish that, and then feel like I've wrapped up remarkably fast on the show and install over the weekend. So, and I'm excited to print also in my apartment where I can also watch Top Chef at the same time.
Totally.
So
awesome.
Yeah.
Sweet. Thank you, Shannon.
Thank you. This is so good.
Yeah.